It's a beautiful spring evening, and as he walked out in the cool of the evening, it felt like him had been a long time he'd been waiting for a night like this. It was almost, it seemed, since he had been a teenager, that all of the pieces seemed to be in place so beautifully. And his life was just where he wanted it to be. He thought about it. He was about 47 years of age now, and he'd wanted so long to make it. There had been promises that had been made, and it looked like for many years those promises would never be fulfilled. He'd been haunted, he'd been driven, he'd been pursued. There always seemed to be somebody coming against him, and yet now it had all come together, and he was at the peak of his game, and the world looked very good. He could think about where he was politically, and a nation that he'd come to, and when he'd come to it, it was weak, and it was frail, and it was failing. It had just suffered a crushing defeat, and now they were the envy of the nations around, and they looked on at him, and he was a success. He was a man who was feared and respected, and his name in foreign countries brought the ring of concern and the kind of awe of appreciation of what he'd accomplished. He took this spring off. He didn't have to do what he'd normally done. It'd been years, he seemed, that he'd always been out there leading the men, leading them to the next challenge and to the next opportunity. This was a good summer. This was a good spring. They were out there, but he didn't need to be. He had a good man who was in charge. Thought about finances and thought about how God had blessed him and the prosperity and the good things he enjoyed. There was money for what he wanted to spend his time on. And as he looked to the north, he could see that little hill. It wasn't much of a hill, but he knew that one day there was going to be there what he'd longed for. And even though he wasn't going to build it, he could lay the plans that for his son or maybe his son after him, there was going to be a place there where the whole nation would come and they would worship God. It was a spring night in Jerusalem, and David felt better about his life, I think, than he'd felt for a long time. And he didn't know that at that moment he was a hair's breadth away from a decision that was going to haunt him for the rest of his life and was going to set loose a bomb of destruction and a wave of devastation that was going to last for generations. As a matter of fact, he'd be remembered more by the choice he was going to make in the next few minutes than for anything else in his life. We're looking at the Ten Commandments on Sunday mornings together through the summertime, and we've come to one that doesn't need much explanation. It doesn't need a whole lot of description. It stands there, and there it is. You shall not commit adultery. Hard to get around that. I mean, we know what adultery is. We put it together in the full biblical sense, and it not only says, you shall not commit adultery, don't be involved with somebody else's marriage partner. Now, that was the strict sense in the Old Testament, but in the light of all that God has to say, it says, you shall not engage in sexual relations outside of a man-woman marriage. Only in within marriage is God's gift of sex to be carried out. And yet that simplest in some ways of all the commands has been a story of failure and heartbreak and falling short that haunts not only the memory of David, but the experience of many of us today. I'd like you to turn with me, not to Exodus chapter 20 and the Ten Commandments, but 2 Samuel chapter 11. And we want to look at David. In this moment of success, when he's climbed the pinnacle and he's about to fall, he becomes the living symbol of what Paul will later write about in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, let him who thinks he stand, take heed lest he fall. Because David's going to fall, and great will be the fall, and great will be the consequences of the fall. Stories told in an unvarnished way, and I'm not interested in wallowing in the details of it any more than I'm interested in pursuing the statistics about divorce and marital unfaithfulness. We all know it, and we see it portrayed in a number of different ways on television every day. We pick up the newspaper, and we find famous and infamous people talking about marital shortcomings. They're surrounding us. Our issue is not to describe them, and it's not even to lament them. It's to ask, how do we fulfill what God wants us? And what happens if we don't fulfill? And how do we get to a place where we never intended to be? In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. We know that as Jordan today, or a little bit further north it would be Syria, but this is particularly Jordan. And David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And David sent messengers to get her. She came to him and he slept with her. She'd purified herself from her uncleanness, referring to her monthly period. Then she went back home. That's it. Not much of a story, just a one-night stand in the life of a king. And if you took one-night stands from the lives of kings down through the ages, you'd get empty libraries. I mean, the right of kings was common and known. Kings had the right to their subjects and to their bodies, and especially in a society such as this. But there's something else. Because what a king who knows God does, and what a king who breaks the law of God does, is something very different from what the world accepts. I don't want to dwell and wallow in the details of why David did what he did, but I also don't want us to miss why he did what he did. And in these four verses, there's a kind of an anatomy of the crumbling of a good man, because David was a good man. He's the sweet singer of Israel who knew what it was to look up to heaven and say, "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want," and write songs that we still sing. A man whom God could look at and say, "David's a man after my own heart," and mean it, and have no asterisks beside it. A man who was a man that you could look up to and say, "I want my son to be like that." And yet David was not a man who was free of failure. And that failure was not the event of a moment. Strikes me as I look at these four verses that there's at least four things we can see as David begins to unravel. The first one's not made much of. It's in verse 1, but there's a kind of environment that's established in David's life. It's almost said by the writer of Samuel in passing. He just simply comments that it was springtime, and springtime was the time when the ground had dried, and that meant that chariots could maneuver without getting stuck in the mud, and horses could go out, and armies could march without having to worry about external conditions. And it was almost like the start of baseball season. It was war season. Because given the kind of geography and given the environment of the time, that was the time you went out to war. That was the time you'd done battle. And David had done that, and he'd done it with great success. He defeated his enemies of the northern kingdom. He defeated the Philistines. He'd begun to conquer. He'd taken Jordan. He'd taken Amnon. He'd taken the Edomites. He'd taken all the people around, and they were now subject to him. And spring after spring after spring, David had led the army out to war. And now, 47 years of age, 48 years of age, he can look at himself and he can say, "Hey, David, why don't you take this spring off? You've got a good man. He's in place. Joab can lead the army. He can bring them into the place where they're going to be. Why don't you just stay back and take it easy?" And he could look at all kinds of things and think, "You know, life's great in Jerusalem. City of David and everything around here is witness to the fact God's been good to me." And I have no doubt he looked up to heaven and thought, "Oh, Lord, you've been good to me. The heavens declare your glory, and Jerusalem declares your goodness to David." It's true, he hadn't been feeling quite the way he'd felt over the years. There'd kind of come a kind of dullness in his soul. The muse didn't come as often. He didn't break out the guitar and sing the songs of Zion. It'd been a while since there'd been that sense in his heart of something he wanted to express about the greatness of God, but it was just a downtime. And his family, he could look at that, and it bothered him a little bit because he remembered what Deuteronomy had said. Deuteronomy had said that when you get a king, he's going to multiply wives. He's not to do that. You're not to be like other kings. But then he could say, but you know, the wives I had, Mike, I married Michael because that was what Saul wanted me to do. It wasn't really a romantic relationship. And some of those other wives, well, that's the way business is carried on here in the Middle East. We don't marry because we want to have that particular woman. We marry because we want an alliance with that king, and we're kind of exchanging favors. And so I haven't really multiplied wives. What I've done is multiply alliances, and the wives just kind of go along. Abigail, she was different. I remember the first time I saw her. What a beautiful woman. And I remember how she set my blood rushing, but she was another man's wife. And she was, that was a clever woman. Beautiful, smart, insightful, decisive. And after her husband died, took Abigail. But she's been letting herself go recently. And she's hitting her 40s too. And the years haven't been that good for Abigail. Point is, you get to verse 1. It's not said in neon letters. There's no warning signs. What happens, though, is David has cultivated in his heart a kind of danger zone. Maybe it's the arrogance of success. Maybe it's the kind of feeling that, I've taken on every challenge from Goliath to the bear and the lion to the Philistines. I'm a winner. And rules aren't written for winners. Maybe it's something arrogant. Maybe it's just pressure. There was those years fighting Saul and hiding from Saul, or fighting Saul's battles, and then fighting Saul and fleeing from him, and then his son Adonijah, and then the Philistines and the Edomites and the Ammonites. Been battle after battle after battle, and now we've made it, and I just need to take a break. I mean, it's hard ruling. It's hard building. It's hard building a nation, building a city, building a kingdom, building an empire. Maybe it was his time of life. Maybe he hit the midlife crisis, 47, 48. Men do strange things then. Back then they couldn't buy red Porsches. I guess they got red chariots. But the point is this. David had cultivated an environment in which the choice of evil became easier. Evil's very seldom the event of a moment. It's giving yourself permission. It's the people that you begin to spend time with. It's the places you go. It's the practices you indulge in. It's the pleasures you permit yourself. And David had cultivated something in his heart. He didn't have anything in mind. He walked out on the roof that evening. He'd slept the afternoon. That wasn't all that unusual. It was good not to think about battles. And he walked up, and he's standing on the rooftop, and he looked over at his neighbor's roof, and hold it. I don't know how many roofs away, there was a beautiful woman. And she was bathing. I mean, there she was. And David's eyes fixed on her. Bathsheba, he didn't know her name, but he didn't have any doubt about her beauty. Bathsheba was a beautiful woman. Now, there's nothing wrong with seeing a beautiful woman and having your eyes directed toward her. There's something wrong with you if you don't have that, if you're a man. And there wasn't something wrong with David looking and being driven by a kind of God-given desire for the opposite sex. But David makes a choice at that point. And he becomes an adventurer. Drawn by her beauty, he lingers. Looking becomes lusting, and vision becomes voyeurism. And he begins to think in his mind, and he moves from attraction to captivity as he begins to play with the thought of Bathsheba. Now, I don't know what Bathsheba's part in this is, to say the least. For a woman up there in a flat roof with higher roofs around to be bathing naked is indiscreet. What was going on in Bathsheba's part, I don't know. I don't think she's guiltless, but she's not the cause of David's problem. David's choices and the things he begins to play with. And I don't know how he said it to somebody else, but he went back inside and he said maybe something like, you know, the men are out there fighting the battles, and we think about them and we talk about them a lot. You know, it just strikes me that we don't think very much about those poor women who are left behind. You know, it must be pretty lonely. Every spring your husband goes off to war, and every spring the women are left behind, and they have to look after the children, and they have hustle. Why don't you find if there's any neighboring women around who were married to military officers? And why don't we invite them over and have just a little... I don't know what he said. Maybe he's more direct than that. He's the king, after all, and king's counselors practice discretion. President Kennedy had people, perhaps King David had people as well, who could arrange liaisons like that. Go and find out who that woman is, you know, three houses down. Knowing the secret would be held in captivity, the word comes back. She's Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam. The wife, maybe said it with a certain emphasis, the wife, underlined, of Uriah the Hittite. David knew Uriah the Hittite's name. He was one of his mighty men. I mean, he was one of his intimate soldiers. He was a Hittite. He was a pagan. He was a foreigner who'd come to trust in the living God, and who'd not only come to trust in the living God, who joined David, fought David's battles. He was a convert, a man who'd trusted God and trusted David, and time after time after time put his life on the line for David. He was a member of his inner circle, a mighty man. That ought to have been warning to David. You don't play with another man's wife. You don't play with Uriah the Hittite's wife, not one of your mighty men's wife, not one of your trusted friends' wives, but the reality is when you get bound into lust, and when lust is controlling you, lust is incredibly self-centered. Lust is incredibly blinding. And all you begin to think about is yourself and what's in it for you. So the second stage is arousal. David has cultivated an environment in which choices to indulge are easier, and now he's aroused his feelings and his passions, and he's engaged them, and they're full bore in terms of arousal, and he's called her. And now undoubtedly the third step is rationalization. We're not told these. I can assure you they went on in his mind. Because David knew, and it's becoming very clear, it comes very clear in the story, he knew that what he was doing was wrong, but how does a man who knows God, how does a man who's in the presence of God, who's written these great songs of God, go where David's going to go? Maybe he told himself, I'm entitled. I mean, there's not another nation around who would even think for a moment if a king sees a beautiful woman, has a desire for her, doesn't matter whether she's somebody else's wife, that's the right of a king. I mean, Pharaoh wouldn't give a second thought to this, and those kings over in Philistia, I mean, they grab for all the gusto they can get. And we're a nation like the other nations. I'm a king that's greater than the other nations. I should have the rights of a king. I deserve what they deserve. Everybody else is doing it in the kingly community. Maybe that's what it was. Maybe it was a little more subtle. Maybe it was a one-night stand. Uriah is a long way away. What he doesn't know won't hurt him. We won't get caught. And it's natural. Two consenting adults. She's willing. I don't know whether Bathsheba's willing or fearful. I mean, when a king commands a command performance, what do you say to him? I do know that Bathsheba wasn't Joseph. I do know that Joseph, in a similar situation, said, I can't commit this great sin against God. And he fled. I can't commit this great sin against my master. Bathsheba doesn't have the passion of her love for God and her love for Uriah that says, I would rather suffer the consequences than fall into the sin. So David can rationalize she's consenting, she's willing, and perhaps she was more than willing. I don't know, maybe he said, my wives don't understand me. I mean, Michael. What a pain Michael's always been. Never forget that time I came into Jerusalem the first time, and this was the greatest moment in my life, and all Michael could do was make some sarcastic comment. And Abigail, well, she just doesn't seem to listen to me anymore. We don't talk the way we used to talk, and she's put on a few pounds. Now I need somebody else. Maybe he said she's lonesome. I mean, women have the same drives as men do, and it's springtime, and the world's coming alive with flowers and romance and all of these other things, and her husband's away, and he's been away every springtime. Maybe she just needs some companionship and some compassion and listening ear. I don't know what words David used. I know that he used something like that because those are the kind of things we tell ourselves. Tell ourselves it doesn't matter, or I'm entitled, or it's not a big deal. Who'll know? Dietrich Bonhoeffer makes the comment that in our members there's a slumbering inclination toward desire which is both sudden and fierce. With irresistible power, desire seizes mastery over the flesh all at once. Secret smoldering fire is kindled. The flesh burns as it inflames. It makes no difference whether it's sexual desire or ambition or vanity or desire for revenge or love of fame and power or greed for money. At this moment, God is quite unreal to us, and nothing is more true of David. At this moment, God is quite unreal to us. He loses all reality, and only desire for the creature is real. Satan does not here fill us with hatred of God, but with forgetfulness of God. The lust thus aroused envelops the mind and will of man in deepest darkness. The powers of clear discrimination and decision are taken from us. It is here that everything within me rises up against the Word of God. So cultivation gives way to gratification. And there's the immediate intervening steps of arousal and rationalization. The text is very clear, doesn't say it. David sent messengers to get her. David sent messengers to take her. She came to him and he slept with her. The next phrase is one that's important just in terms of giving the setting and also something about the psychology. It's strange, isn't it? She purified herself from her uncleanness, which is just a graphic way of saying she just had her menstrual period. And she couldn't enter into religious worship again. She couldn't go into the tabernacle to worship God until she'd gone through a ritual of cleanliness. Why is that said? For two reasons. One is there can be no doubt if there's going to be a child, it's going to be David's child and not Uriah's. She'd just been through her period. And the other part of it is just a kind of irony. Isn't it intriguing? So fastidious about religious ritual. Making sure she's doing all of the right things so she can go into the public worship of God and at the same time willing to lie with David in a bed of passion. But it happens all around us. I mean, it happens and we know the story. Sadly happens. We have men who stand in the pulpit and preach the word and during the week they're living somewhere else. We've got people who come to worship and sit in worship and sing the songs of God and part of our hearts. And I think it's not an issue of straight out hypocrisy. Sometimes it's an issue of the very dividedness of our own being. How is it that the very same heart can worship God? And I have no doubt that David went into the tabernacle and when he sang hymns, he cried and wept because there was a love for God within him, but there was also a waywardness and a lust at the same time. Aren't we strange people? And sometimes there's something far more evil lurking in us, but we're simply told she went back home. That was it. It was a one-night stand. And I'm sure David thought back on that. Maybe he wrote her name down. I don't know whether there was any intention of following it up. There's no suggestion in the text that there was. It was an event in the king's life. It was a moment of indiscretion, a one-night fling, a moment of passion in which it was aroused. And then he went back to life as normal. And it was easy for David to think that I got away with another one. But the issue is that David had failed in a way deeper than he understood. He'd broken faith with his wives. That wasn't new. He'd done that before. He'd broken faith with Bathsheba. He'd used her for his purposes. He'd broken faith with a trusted friend and fellow warrior who'd fought side by side and laid down his life for his cause, Uriah. He'd broken faith with God Himself. And he'd broken faith with himself. His son is going to write something in Proverbs that's rather striking. His son is going to visit these same wayward moments, and his son writes in Proverbs 6, verse 27, "Can a man scoop fire into his lap without his clothes being burned? Can a man walk on hot coals without his feet being scorched? So is he who sleeps with another man's wife. No one who touches her will go unpunished. A man who commits adultery lacks judgment. Whoever does so destroys himself." And Paul will pick that up in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and says that's true of all sex outside of marriage. Every other sin a person commits is outside their body. He who commits sexual immorality sins against his own self. And Solomon will write, "Stolen water is sweet." And that night with Bathsheba had been sweet. "Food eaten in secret is delicious," and there had been a sense of adventure he hadn't sensed with his wives for a long time. But little do they know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of the grave. I want you to notice the phrase that ends verse 4. "She went back home." I want you to notice the phrase that ends chapter 11. Very last phrase. "Thing David had done displeased the Lord." It wasn't over. As a matter of fact, it was only just beginning. It was Charles Spurgeon who once said, "God will not allow his children to sin successfully." God will not allow his children to sin successfully. When we lived in Calgary, the Bow River runs through Calgary. It's not a major river, but it is a fast-moving one, one of the great trout-fishing rivers, I'm told, in North America, although I'm not a trout fisherman, so that didn't matter much to me. But it was a place where you could canoe and kayak and do other things. But in the city, they had, as the river ran through the city, they built some weirs. That is, they built some areas where they'd put a concrete weir in, kind of dam, and then the water would come over the top. And the undertow was extremely dangerous, so there were signs all over the river, "Do not canoe past this point, do not canoe past this point." And there was a cable stretched out of the river to pass it, because the danger was, it looked very easy. I mean, you'd drive along the road and you'd see the weir and you'd think, "I could go over that, I don't understand what all the fuss is about." But the undertow was incredibly vicious, and virtually everyone who got in, I don't know of a case where anybody who got in was rescued alive. It just sucked people under and they drowned. And almost every spring, without exception, somebody drowned in the weir on the Bow River while we were there. Now, there were signs up, "Do not canoe any further." It wasn't put up by somebody who didn't like canoeing. The restriction wasn't because the people were against canoeing. It was because they were against drowning. And when God says, "You shall not commit adultery," it's not because God is against sexual enjoyment. It is because God is against sexual devastation and personal devastation. It's because He's for sexual enjoyment, and He's created the boundaries in which that takes place to its fullness. Verse 5 introduces the chain of consequences. I want to pursue these quickly and not in depth, but just to notice that when the woman back home, it was a week that went by, and another week, and another week. I don't know, maybe it was 6 weeks, maybe it was 10 weeks later. There was a note that arrived at the palace. It was carefully sealed. It was for David's eyes only. And as he opened the note and he read it, an icy fear hand grabbed around David's throat, and he felt a chill go through his whole being. "I'm expecting. I'm having a child." David knew what God had said. God had said, if you sleep with another man's wife, you shall surely die. And all of a sudden, one night of dalliance became one night of danger, horrible danger to David personally. For Bathsheba, she'd already lost her ability to look at herself as she once had, to look at her husband and to embrace him in the fullness of her love. She knew that life within her. How could she explain this to her husband? Her religious ceremony of having purified herself was public knowledge. There was no way she could explain the child. And she felt not only the threat of losing her husband and losing the child, but losing her own life. And David felt that as well. And he begins to know the physical consequences of his actions are real and significant, that the moment was not only a moment, it's now going to last on. And there are always consequences. They don't always arrive immediately. Sometimes they're not physical, but they're very real. As David begins to act this out, he immediately gives evidence. He knows what God's will is. He fights and he runs and he denies and he hides and he covers up. His ability to cover up makes Richard Nixon look like a fool. He works at Uriah. But the striking thing is that what really is covered up is David's character. He changes. He becomes a different kind of man. He becomes cold. He becomes hard. He becomes calculating. He becomes vicious in a way he had never been before. This was Uriah. The note goes out to Joab, send back Uriah. I need a report. And he brings Uriah in and he says, Uriah, come. It's really hard to stay at home. It's the first spring I haven't been out there with the boys at the battle. And tell me about it. Is Joab really capable? Tell me about some of his tactics and tell me about his strategies. And they sit and they talk war. And men love to talk war. And they talk tactics like going over halftime of a football game, talking about the tactics and the methods. And then David's, I'm so glad you, Uriah, thank you. I couldn't be there. I'd love to be there, but what you told me just made me believe Joab is the right man and the war's gone well. And you've always meant a lot to me, and that's why I wanted you to come back. And you know something? I know you can't get back to the men tonight. So why don't you just stay home and enjoy a night with your wife. She's probably lonely. She'd love to know you're back in town. And go back tomorrow. And for David, that's it. I mean, he'll go, he'll do the obvious thing. He'll spend time with his wife. The child will not be your known whose child it is. And life can go on as normal. But next morning, the word comes that Uriah hadn't gone home. One of the servants brings in the food and says, that Uriah is quite a man. He's all night with us, just telling his war stories. Didn't even bother going home. And David says, what's going on? And Uriah comes in. I said, I couldn't do that, David. You've always had the rule that when we're at battle, we're celibate and we stay away from women. And even though you gave me permission, all I could think of is my men out there. And they're not doing that. And how can I lead them and indulge myself at the same time? It's like a knife in David's heart. So he says, well, I got some business. I got some reports. Why don't you stay overnight and go back? And then the next night he tries to get him drunk, but Uriah doesn't. And finally David ends up doing what he had never imagined he could have done. He orders Joab to put Uriah in a place where he's going to be killed. Uriah is killed. Others are killed because Joab has to maneuver it in a particular way. And when the word comes back, David says in verse 25, how does this upset you? The sword devours one as well as another. And David has turned into a cold-blooded murderer of Uriah, a man who'd done no wrong, and he's begun to take the life of others around him. And then in chapter 12, when he finally does go up to Syria, up to Rabbah, and they conquer the city, there's a horrible thing that's said. It's not put that way in the New International Version. The New American puts it that way, that when prisoners of war are taken, it says David put them under the sword, under the saw. And it seems to mean, although most translators pull back because it seems to be too gross, that David had them sawed into. Sad thing is, I believe it because I've seen what men have done who followed this course of action. I've sat across the table and said, don't do it. If you do this, I hate to think of what you're going to do to your wife and what you're going to do to your children, but you're going to become a man I won't recognize. And I've watched and I've watched and I've watched and I've watched. I hate to be a prophet who's right on times like that, but every time I've said it, I've seen ugliness I could not believe. And a person who said, I'll never do that. David had become a hard person. And then there's family consequences. I don't have time to go into that, but the family's going to begin to unravel. David is going to see things happen, and he's going to hear that his own son has raped his half-sister and then won't have anything to do with her. And David is going to look at Amnon and hear the report, and he's going to feel the guilt in his heart and say, I know what I've done. How can I discipline my son? And then his son Absalom is going to become the avenger. He's going to kill his brother, his half-brother Amnon. And David's going to look at Absalom and say he's angry with him, and then he's going to bring him back. But he's going to be able to say, how can I deal? I can't even look my son Absalom in the eye. And Absalom's going to fall into a course of behavior exactly like his father's. And the family's going to be devastated. Dysfunction is going to run wild. No family more dysfunctional in the Bible than David's family. And its seedbed is right here in a choice that he made to indulge and hide. And then finally, he's going to witness the death of Bathsheba's son, and the death of Amnon, and the death of Absalom, and the death of Adonijah. And the ultimate disruption of his nation. The thing that David did displeased the Lord. Maybe that's the greatest consequence of all. There's the physical consequence and the personal consequence and the family consequence, but it displeased the Lord. In chapter 12, God will say through Nathan, you have despised the Lord. David, you just haven't blundered. You haven't fallen into a moment of passion. You've despised me. Because when people who know God indulge themselves and forget all about God, that is an act of despising God himself. You've got no control over the way I use my physical bodies, Lord. My physical body, I'll do it my way, thank you. You've despised me. And David said, I felt at that moment and for the year that intervened in Psalm 32 like a sponge that's thrown into the middle of the desert and dries and shrivels up. All my juices, all of my vitality, all of my insides were gone. I felt like a man who was in the middle of a desert just shriveling and dying. And for a year, David spends his time and energy in denial and in deceit and in deception and cover up, and I think in depression, if Psalm 32 is to be believed, because he knows what he's done to himself and he knows what he's done to God, but he cannot look God in the eye. And the consequences are real. Sooner or later, everyone sits down to a banquet of consequences. And David's banquet was on the garbage dump. Because you don't break God's laws, you break yourself on God's laws. Well, the story doesn't end there, gratefully. We don't have much time for chapter 12, but I couldn't tell you the story without it. Because there's an antidote to adultery. I mean, when you've committed it. There's an antidote to the whole issue, and that is don't fall into it, but the antidote is to understand God's grace. Nathan's given a terrible assignment by God. Go and tell David what he's done is sin against me, and I know all about it. And I can imagine Nathan saying, couldn't I have another assignment? Send me to Egypt. I'd rather go there. Because to go to a king who had life and death authority and say, you're the man, but Nathan was sent by God. Nathan loved David. He was the one who denounced the terms of the Davidic covenant, but he thinks carefully about how can I come to the king, and he tells a story. He knows David. He knows the real David down beneath. And when he talks about this story of exploitation of a poor man, David rises to the challenge and said, that man must be put to death. And Nathan looks at him and says, you're the man. And that finger pointing by the prophet Nathan went right into the heart of David. And for that moment, God in his grace broke through in power in his life, and David said three words that unloosed all of the chains. He just said, I've sinned. No rationalization, no explanation, no sin, no denial, no anything. Just, I've sinned. I've sinned. And think of what that meant. Think of what it means to stand in front of the prophet of God and say, I've sinned, when the sin is adultery and the penalty for sin is death. And as all David knew at that moment, all he could know was the prophet of God could say, right, stones, man, let's go. It was a moment of utter brokenness and dependence before God. I've sinned. I'm the man. But in that moment of absolute final vulnerability, of humility and openness before God and before others, is the way of freedom. And we've seen it in our own country. I won't make the parallel. Imagine how the course of American history would have been different if a president had managed to come onto the screen and say, I've done wrong. I covered up. But he wouldn't. I sinned. And David hears Nathan say the most amazing thing in response to that. Nathan's word is, the Lord's taken away your sin. You won't die. Whew. David didn't know that it was because God the Son was going to go to the cross and bear his own sin on the cross. He didn't know all that we know about that. That the reason that Nathan could declare him forgiven is that God had declared Jesus Christ to be the sacrifice in his place. You're forgiven. You're forgiven. Now please notice, the forgiveness did not mean the removal of consequences. Nathan says to him in verse 14 of chapter 12, because by doing this you've made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die, and he'll talk about other things. The sword will not depart from your house. Forgiveness does not mean the removal of consequences. It means removal of guilt before God. Stories told of a man who jumped off the World Trade Center building, and he was about 15 stories down, and all of a sudden he felt a blow of repentance come over him. He said, oh Lord, it's wrong for me to take my life. Please forgive me. I've sinned against you. Please forgive me for having done this. And as he was going down the side of the building, as the story goes, a voice came back to him. He said, of course I forgive you. Don't think a thing about it. I'll never bring it up again. And by the way, I'll see you in a few seconds. It's an obvious story. You jump off a building, you may be forgiven by God if you repent on the way down, but you're still going to hit bottom. And David is going to know consequences, but his need is to humbly reach out and lay hold of the forgiveness of God. And he says it so beautifully in Psalm 51, verses 16 and 17, when he says, sacrifices, offerings you don't desire, but a broken and contrite spirit you won't despise. Now, the Old Testament was very clear. You could not bring a broken sacrifice. You couldn't bring a sacrifice with any flaw in it, but the one sacrifice God will accept is a broken heart. And David accepted his forgiveness. And in Psalm 32, he writes out of this, all the blessedness of the one whose sin is forgiven, whose iniquity is covered, to whom the Lord will not impute iniquity. And he's commenting on what Nathan had said to him. Your sin's forgiven. And he received forgiveness. But David doesn't end there. That's why as Psalm 51 says, I don't want to get back into that. Lord, create in me a clean heart. Renew a right spirit, a steadfast spirit within me. And David's committed not simply to repent of sin and receive forgiveness, but to restructure his life and ask God to make him new from the heart up. And we need to do that, to understand where God works. Well, our time is more than gone. Let me just conclude with this. The story of David tells us that there are warnings we must not ignore. We cannot play with the law of God.